It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
You know, we all deal with our past. By the way, welcome to Money for Lunch, in case you didn't know where you were at. Anyway, it's good to have you here. I'm excited to have you here, because what I was starting to say is that our past, most of the time, has the ability to sabotage us, right? And sometimes it's very visible and easy to detect, and other times not so easy to detect. My first guest today is the best-selling author of the book Undo, How to Undo Your Past and Plan Your Future. And if you really want to, get an idea of, about this book, one of my favorite things about this book is its cover. And the cover basically has a knotted up rope in the shape of a brain, and it's got, a hand undoing the knots. And I just thought it was so fitting. Anyway, it was just something that caught my attention. I had to have Matt on the show. Matt Powell has written 4 books on learning and psychology, built an international martial art organization, filming 100 of instructional videos and personally teaching thousands around the world, all while working his way up the corporate ladder. Matt has experienced a variety of success and failures in his quest to create a better life for himself and those around him. Matt now focuses his time, personal growth, and successful living topics through his new project, Pastless.net. Using his experience teaching around the world to create innovative methods that anyone can use to further their life, like his new book, Undo, How to Undo Your Past and Plan Your Future. Matt Powell, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. And I'm excited
appreciate
to have you here.
On.
Oh, you bet. And I want to start off by asking you, what was the catalyst, the motivation to write this book?
You know, a friend of mine passed away, and before he did, we had grown up together. I mean, we had grown up in the same neighborhood, playing in the same forts and going to the same schools, and I had no idea. He had a rare form of cancer, and I had no idea that he had been following my martial art work for so long, for years. And, you know, I had gotten to this point where I had written a number of books, I had all these videos, and he was getting it all, but since he was so sick with cancer, and his cancer went on for years, he couldn't do a lot of what the videos showed. And so I ended up finding out through the grapevine that he was following it. And I ended up calling him up, and we started talking. And as he got closer to the end, we talked more and more about all kinds of topics. I mean, dogs and girls, religion, business. He had a successful small business himself. And I took a lot of notes. And years later, I was driving down to the beach house, and I was listening to my audio notes from the time, and I was, one hand on the wheel and one hand, on my iPad looking at my notes. And one of the things that he kept saying was, I think you can do more than this. You taught so many people, you developed so many things. I think you could do more. Maybe if you wrote a book for new college graduates or just something other than martial arts. And I said, you know what? I can. So I sat down on the deck over the beach, and I just started writing a bunch of books. And I wrote, I started writing 4 different books. I was there for 5 days, and each day I wrote about 20 pages in 4 different books. And it started leading me down this path. This was a couple of years ago. And 2 of the books started to combine into this idea that you know, like you were saying a moment ago, that the past can sabotage us. So what do we do about that? And I had learned so much from teaching, you know, martial art and combatives and all these different things about how the brain operates, how it works under stress, that I just decided, you know, I'm really going to attack the way that the brain is processing things, but I'm going to do it kind of in a systematic nature with a book that people can follow to start planning. Because if you address the past, but you don't have a plan for the future, you're not really going anywhere. And so, you know, Barry passing away was kind of that catalyst of, you know, one day I'm going to die. Have I done more than teach somebody to, you know, punch somebody else in the nose? So that's how the book grew.
Awesome. Awesome. And it's amazing. First of all, what a simple little remark. You can do more, and it sent you down this way. It started you with, like you said, this weekend of writing at the beach house there. And the book again is Undo: How to Undo Your Past and Plan Your Future. Let me ask you this: how do you go about undoing your past? I mean, is that just too much to deal with? Because some people, first of all, the way I understand it, the way I've seen it, and I want to get your opinion on this, there are people who think they've had a bad, quote, past, right? A bad childhood, a bad whatever experience, and sometimes it's not true. Sometimes it's just in their head more than anything else. And I guess if it's a perception, you know, if you perceive it to be bad, then it is bad. And I'm talking about maybe somebody who's complaining that their parents didn't love and support them enough. I'll use that as a variable. But in reality, their parents loved and supported them as much as they could. You know, they were good people. They helped them through college, helped them achieve whatever. But still, this person's unsatisfied. And then you have those people who truly have a bad experience. They were abused. They were neglected. Some people who were abandoned. And so how do you go about undoing your past? What's the first step?
You were talking about something when you opened it up, and it reminded me of a comment that I made to my sister one day, which was, you know, living is sometimes like being a bellhop. You know, you're getting baggage and you're hauling it around. And so, you know, the way that the brain processes information is that the conscious mind interacts with what is happening in front of it. And then every night it takes the memories of what happened. And there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus basically takes all these things that the conscious brain experienced during the day, and it catalogs it for the unconscious brain. So your conscious brain can always be pulling from the unconscious brain to make assumptions about what is going to happen. And what happens in reality, and so that's great when, you know, you're on the plains of Savannah, you know, 25 million years ago or whatever, you know, our ancient ancestors, and if they didn't know, you know, what the saber-toothed tiger smelled like, they were going to die. So, you know, the brain was always processing this information, trying to make assumptions. But when we live day-to-day now, our brain sometimes works against us, like you were just talking about, and we pick up all this baggage from when we were a kid, and then we pick up a bag from the way that our mom treated us, and we pick up a bag from the bully in fifth grade, and then the bad boss in our teens, and next thing you know, you've got this huge thing of baggage that you're wheeling around life's hotel, and you have no idea how to, you know, what rooms do these go in? And so the first thing to do is not look at, you know, what you fail at or what happened, but you kind of have to look at the why. One of the things that we tend to do is that we look at life on a linear timeline. We look at it event to event to event to event. And if you look at it event to event, yes, it's too much because you become overwhelmed. So, you know, all of these events that happen to you, you just keep looking at them and you try to solve that one event. And then you go on your daily life and then you're trying to solve this event. Instead, you have to look at it, you know, more as a circular. You have to look at it for the themes behind those events. You know, you can fix the themes, but you can't fix the event itself. So, you know, the themes are what sabotage you. They are what stick with you. They are the things that stay with you day to day and create these kind of habits of failure that happen to you. And so the first thing that you have to do is that you have to realize that you can't fix these events that happen to you. You can, as you know, as popularly said, only really focus on the way that you react to them years later. And so what we do with undo is we try to push through that first. So we look at, and we do it in a systemized way with the book, and then you get a workbook with the book. In the workbook, you actually write all this stuff out and start going through this process that, you know, that works with the book. And you list all these things out. And then you start trying to find these themes behind the things that you've been failing at or the goals that you set that you didn't achieve. And then you start addressing those themes and, you know, setting your life up to where those themes stop sabotaging you. Every morning when you get up, you've got kind of life's habits that you, you know, in these bags that you're dragging around. So we try to get rid of that first. Sure. And then we take this kind of, okay, I'm not going to let those themes affect me anymore. I've created some different things in my life in terms of the way that I schedule it or the way that I'm going to start conversations or whatever. Now I'm going to plan for the future. And so if you look at it in a linear fashion and you try to fix events that happen to you, it can't be done because, you know, it's not back to the future. You can't jump into the DeLorean and go back. You got to have to find what the themes are from the things that happened and how they're affecting you today and attack those themes instead and then start moving towards the future.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. So let's talk about this, because something that's interesting to me is a lot of people end up, and I'm kind of switching gears here, guys, so just keep up with me. But a lot of people end up leaving their day job once they reach a certain level of success with their, you know, side business, if you will. But you didn't do that. You stayed when you could have left your day job. Talk about that. Why did you stay?
It really goes back to this concept of, you know, undo and looking at the past, because you can not only learn from your past as an entrepreneur or somebody in business or, you know, even, you know, with a family, but you can look at other people's past and you can really see what's happening with them and, you know, what are they doing and what lessons can I learn from that? You know, and I started being, you know, this whole entrepreneur side and back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the internet was just starting to get going. And I saw a lot of people year after year making mistakes that someone who had worked in a regular business in management would have never made. And I started trying to, you know, figure out, like, why are these people, why am I seeing this guy make this mistake with marketing? Why is this guy making this mistake with management? Why is this girl making a mistake with, you know, the supply side of what she's trying to sell in her entrepreneurial-based business? And, you know, I think I was trying to figure this out as I was going through it, and I was wanting to quit my day job. Because I wanted to be like everybody else. It was like, I want to run this business and I'm going to work for myself. And I think it's about deciding, you know, will I be CEO of someone else's company or will I be the CEO of my company? And the mindset that takes place there, and a lot of what I talk about is, you know, in mindset, is that you either set about learning every department to make it better for someone else's company that you want to run one day, or you learn how they operate so that for your own business is better. Because I learned a ton in operations. I learned a ton in marketing, and I got paid for it. And, you know, I was learning how to run my business on someone else's dime. I was, you know, one of the guys that I worked for, he was, you know, he went from rags to riches, multimillionaire, stores all over the place, all this stuff. And one day he told me, he said, I'm going to give you an MBA if you work for me. I'm going to give you an MBA in being an entrepreneur that you're never going to have to pay for. And, you know, next thing I knew, the higher I went in my day job, the higher my entrepreneur side of, you know, my businesses, my side businesses, the higher they went. So I found a way to split the difference. I became just really efficient at both. so I could make twice the income and work half as hard. I was learning so many ways of doing, you know, my work in each part of my life that they were making the other more efficient and better. So I was getting paid to do both, and I wasn't having to work as hard because I was getting much smarter about my work. So that's why I decided not to quit the day job. And even today, I haven't quit the day job, and I never will, because I learned so much on someone else's dime that makes my company successful and makes me more efficient as a businessman.
Well, you know what? And it's so funny because when you started to say, you know, I wanted to be like everybody else, and instantly what crept into my head was, you know, everybody else who leaves a known environment to start off in a new environment, and they quickly find out that it takes more money, more time, and you struggle and doing this and that. So not always the most fun experience. So the way you're doing it, I think it is quite smart. I mean, you're having your cake and eating it too. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that more of us should do that. I mean, if you love what you're doing on your quote day job, and it gives you, as you said, it gives you not only the money, but it gives you ideas. It gives you an MBA. It's helping you get out of your head a little bit, which happens a lot to entrepreneurs. Therefore, you're able to work on your business versus in your business, which is another mistake that a lot of entrepreneurs do. They just work on their business. So to me, it seems like the best of both worlds.
You put it perfectly. You know, I always tell people, especially with passless, like I'm not here to teach you how to be rich. There's a whole lot of people that, I mean, I'm very comfortable in my life, but there's a whole lot of people that will teach you how to be rich. But I'll teach you how in the brain, how your brain works, and I'll teach you how to be happy. But being rich is another thing. And I think when people like to work, and even if it's on a video game or around the house, people like to work. And yes. I think if you're able to start to balance, you know, the entrepreneur side, I think a lot of people get in their mind, I'm going to quit my job, I'm going to work for myself, I'm the man, this is what I'm going to do. Because they look out there and they see all these people that are doing it. And instead, you have to step back a little bit. And like you said, you know, you're going from a known environment to an unknown environment. So why not take some baby steps, you know, and do it a little bit slowly? And I think what I have found, and most people that I know, especially nowadays with the internet, is that most people are starting to stay in their day job and using the internet, obviously, to make that side money. And, you know, it's really about changing the mindset and taking all the lessons you're learning at work to make that side business more effective and more efficient. And then you make it work, you go to another one. You know, I started Prom years ago, and I've had different brands that I've started up, and I've grown them a little bit, and I've sold them. Start one up, grow it, sell it. Because I just learned exactly how to do it watching the companies that I worked for, how they were making their decisions.
Let's talk about this real quick. Let's talk about some of the mistakes you made. You've been in business since 2002. When you look back, what are some of the learning experiences, i.e. mistakes that you made?
You remember AOL? Remember America Online?
Sure.
I feel like in terms of, you know, the online business and so forth, I really started back in those days. I mean, I remember when I first started doing this, it was 97 is when I first started being around this. And I mean, it was literally, you've got mail. And I was checking the email from what people were doing. And, you know, what's interesting is that when a lot of people that I know, you know, they're starting their side business now, or they're starting to be an entrepreneur now and so forth, and the technology is moving. And I was always late transitioning in technology. And that is a gigantic mistake that I made in the early days. I'll give you an example in the martial art world. Used to, you know, it was all about DVDs. You were just buying DVDs and buying DVDs of people teaching. and you open up Black Belt magazine, you buy some DVDs. And it was like the Jim Rohn of martial art. Like, my dad used to get his Zig Ziglar and Jim Rohn tapes, and then he'd drive for, 2 weeks on business trips listening to those tapes. And, one day it was CDs, and my dad bought a car, and he had nothing but tapes, and there was no tape deck. There was a CD player. And I had done the same thing when I went, I had DVDs, and then downloadable videos became this big thing, and I was crushing myself with overhead because I didn't want to transition to the new technology. I'd put all these processes in place to support the DVDs. And so nowadays, when you see a technology, when I see one, and I think it can help just a little bit, I'll download it, I'll try it out, I'll see how I can use it, I'll, see if it makes me more efficient, and then, I'll use it if I need to. And the other one that, really the big mistake that I made back in those days that I don't make anymore is when there's new platforms, I don't try to slam my business into the platform. You are your brand. I am my brand at the end of the day. And for a lot of new businesses, the individual that starts it is the brand until the brand's reputation becomes bigger than the individual. And those are the types of things that, in the early days, I trusted too many people with too many things, and I gave too many people the ability to hurt the brand. There's delegating, and then there's trusting people with your brand. And I was a little bit too trusting in the early days. And, in 2002, nobody really thought about a lot of this kind of stuff. It was the wild, wild west. Now there's, a blog for this, there's podcasts. Back then, people didn't understand a lot of these things. And, a lot of it was just people that were working for companies, starting up their own businesses and doing things like that. So, transitioning on technology, I try to get on the wave as fast as I can, see if it'll help me, and then, really paying attention to the people that are around me. I've seen people fold $50, $60 million entrepreneurial businesses because of the people around them. So, those are the two things that I really learned early when I made mistakes.
I love it. I love it. Matt, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more. The book is Undo, How to Undo the Past and Plan Your Future by Matthew Powell, available on Amazon. Matthew, it's been a blast having you on the show. Looking forward to having you back again.
Hey, I really appreciate it. And people can always, all of my social media is I Am Matt Powell. So if they go to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, it's I Am Matt Powell. Hopefully they'll contact me there. They'll be able to pick up Undo. And I really appreciate you having me on today. Thank you so much.
You bet. You bet. Good stuff there from Matt Powell. One of the things that one of the big mistakes that I made when I had a thriving executive corporate job, and I had in my side gig started taking off, I did exactly what Matt said a lot of people do, and that is you leave your successful job to go run your successful business. And a lot of that was, I have to say, was pride. If I would have humbled myself and kept both of them going, I think I would have made different choices. Of course, 2020 is always, or hindsight is always 2020. Anyway, but I think a lot of my mistakes personally have been from pride, thinking that I'm all that, and then come to realize I'm not all that at all. Anyway, quick commercial break, and then we're back with David Scranton right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, we are back. My next guest, David Scranton. David Scranton is best-selling author of Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and in Bad. David's also the CEO and founder of Sound Income Strategies, or is it Three Sound Income Strategies? We'll verify that in a second. David Scranton, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Well, thank you, Bert. Thanks for having me. It's exciting.
You bet. You know what? And so the book, again, is Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. And the name of your company, is it Sound Income Strategies or is it Three Sound Income Strategies? Because I see a three above it.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. It's Sound Income Strategies, but thanks for the clarification. I appreciate it.
All right. So we're going to get right into this because I think, you know, David, and I want your opinion on this. I think that most people, certainly the good folks that I have met here in the great United States, we tend to have a really messed up, I would say, love-hate relationship when it comes to money. We want the money. We love what it does for us. But then sometimes we get the money and we spend it, or in some cases we get into debt and we have this love-hate relationship with money. Do you find that to be true?
I find that to be true a lot of times, and I've coached people. You know, one of the things we do as a company is not just work with individual investors, but we also coach financial advisors how to become better at what they do. And, in fact, this is part of what even tempted me to write this book, is that I found people that are very good managing or pretty good managing other people's money, financial advisors, but yet it seems like every year if their income goes up by $100,000 or $200,000, they can't save it. They end up just blowing the money. And usually it's something that's deep-seated in our roots, something that we have or don't have within us, which precludes us from being good with our own funds. One quick story was that there was this actual particular individual coaching him. He's a very successful financial advisor. And what I found in his case was that every time he got a dollar, he'd turn around, he'd spend it on something else. And his personal budget grew as his income grew. And what I finally dug down deep with him, psychologically speaking, was that he had grown up with two parents who were teachers. And they never made a ton of money. It was just the last 30 years or so teachers started to become more financially successful. But what they had is they had a limiting belief. They said, they had this belief that said that if you're affluent, then you must be taking advantage of somebody else. You must be taking advantage of the poor people if more of the money and the wealth happen to come to you. So we had to finally get down to this limiting belief that this is what was causing him unconsciously to pull back, so that it was almost like money was dirty. And every time he got a dollar extra, he'd have to cleanse himself by purging and getting rid of it. And I don't know if that's that hippopotamus part of the brain, as your previous guest was talking about. But that's what happened with him. So, yes, this happens a lot with investors. And that's why, you know, when I chose to write a book about money, it wasn't going to be about a how-to book about financial algorithms. It was going to be more about determining whether or not you have the inside game, if you have the right mental makeup to do it yourself. But if you have a financial advisor, to also be prompted with questions to ask your financial advisor whether or not he or she has the right mental makeup to truly be a good advisor. So I think I'm going to make a lot of enemies from financial advisors as a result of this book, but I guess I'm willing to take that risk.
You have to stir the pot a little bit. It's always good to make some noise and change things up. And I want to talk about this because it's so important. One of the things that's confusing to me, and I think it's confusing to a lot of people, is that it seems like everybody's called a financial advisor. So there is a fiduciary financial advisor, a certified financial advisor. There's you name it. There's a financial advisor for just about every possible, situation. So what do I look for?
Well, it's why I always say that anyone can hang a shingle and call themselves a financial advisor, and there's no rule or law against it. And what makes it difficult is that in the medical world, you know, if I told you that, you know, I had lower back pain, I went to four different medical professionals and they recommended four different things, you would understand that once I told you the rest of the story, that the first person was an orthopedic surgeon, the second was a chiropractor, the third was an acupuncturist, and the fourth was a physical therapist. They all recommend different things because they do different things. The problem in the financial world is that people tend to, the average investor tends to paint us all with the same brush, that we're all financial advisors. And the reality of it is they are different. So, yeah, there are the basics. You know, for example, I believe firmly that, for example, someone who's an insurance agent isn't a financial advisor. Someone who's a broker isn't a financial advisor. To me, you've got to be able to offer all things. So if you're an insurance agent and a broker and you do financial advisory work, okay, then maybe you're a financial advisor. And there's a whole argument whether, gee, you're better off on the fee-based fiduciary side, paying somebody a fee to manage money, or whether you're working with somebody on a commission basis, collecting a commission. And I always hate to get in the middle of that because there are good people on both sides of that argument. The reality, though, right, to me, the most important thing is to fish out the inside game, to fish out whether or not the advisor has the right internal stuff. Because, you know, a lot of doctors go to medical school because, A, they're smart enough to pass, and, B, because they want to make the money that they perceive, you know, doctors to be making. And the reality is that, you know, that's all great, but none of them are probably going to become the next Dr. House. You know, they're never going to be somebody who's got that natural gut instinct at it because they're doing it for the wrong reasons. And the same is true of financial advisors. A lot of people are lured into the business based upon the money. And as a result, they're never going to really be as good as they can because they don't love it. They don't have that internal knack for it. So I tell people in our book that that's what you have to look out for. Don't worry. You know, the designations and all that stuff are nice, but the real thing is this concept of the internal game.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because it's all about the internal game.
In life,
You know, you look at relationships, you look at health, you look at money, you look at anything else that you want to be successful. I think it starts and ends with the inside game, because that really determines how much effort you're going to put into it, how much, you know, determines, you know, what level of success you're going to have. Everything's an inside game. I want to talk about this. You know, when it comes to assets, I hear a lot about asset allocation. For a client at my stage in life, here I am, I'm 54. I'll be 54 this year. Should I be in stock? Should I be in mutuals? Should I be, you know, what should I be looking for? And again, okay. I want to clarify this. I want to say this real quick, just in case, you know, that I'm not asking necessarily for advice, and I don't want anybody to construe what we're doing today as advice, but just as a demonstration of the possibilities. And, you know, definitely you need to consult with a professional, but I just wanted to tee that up that way and make sure that just in case we need to clarify some, what do you call it, some disclosure there.
Sure. Well, first of all, since you are actually 2 years older than myself, and I always respect my elders, I guess I'm going to have to start referring to as Sir throughout the rest of the show. But you brought in a very good point. Where should people be invested? And, you know, for example, the reason we called my TV show The Income Generation, there's a reason behind it. You know, the income generation is everyone 50 and over. People who need to start focusing a little less on crossing their fingers and toes, hoping to get growth, and instead focus some of their money on investing for income. And quite frankly, I believe the financial world has done us a disservice, advisors, investors alike, because they taught us the most important thing to determine the amount of risk we take in our portfolio should be our risk tolerance level, which really is loosely interpreted by the industry as your time horizon. So one would argue that, you know, even if you're 62 years old, you're going to retire in 3 years. Well, you might live to be 90. You still have a decent time horizon. Well, where I think they've done all of us a disservice is that there's a second part that investors should be considering that's never, never talked about by the financial industry, and that is whether or not you're likely to get rewarded for taking risk. You know, logical people don't want to take risk just for the sake of taking risk. They only want to take risk if there's reward. So risk tolerance is the first part, but where the markets are is truly a second part. And you know, that's where, again, where I think they've done us a disservice. And when you look at the markets today, you know, things being at a record high, the volatility we've seen just over the last couple of days in the markets, realizing that quantitative easing is a big reason why we've seen these high levels in the markets short term, you know, it's all the more reason why people need to really sit back and start to think about, okay, am I going to, if I'm going to take extra risk, even if I'm with my normal risk tolerance parameters, am I really going to get rewarded for this risk, or should I try to go into fixed income, make 4 or 5% and be happy? And the sad part about this, Bert, is I believe the reason the financial industry doesn't talk about this is because they want us to believe financial markets are totally random and have no repeatability and no predictability. And personally, I disagree. I share in the book, Return on Principal, I share evidence that I used to pull all my clients out of the market in 1998, 1999 to protect them from that drop, and the same evidence that I used to pull my clients out of the market in 2006 and 7 before the second drop. And so I believe that despite the evidence that I've used that I find to be helpful and predictable and repeatable throughout history to improve my own clients' sense of well-being, what I find is that that's evidence that is not taught to most financial advisors. Why? Because Wall Street really wants advisors to think the markets are random, so advisor will throw up their hands and keep people invested in the markets 24/7.
And I think that the other thing, again, not to sound like an attorney, but it makes their job easier. If everything's random, then listen, I can't help you out. You know, I can't predict when the market's going to do this or that, you know, because who can? If they were out there saying, hey, it's predictable, every 7 or 8 years we're going to have this cycle, or every 10 years expect this, which I think historically, if you look back, it does happen, it seems like every 7 to 10 years, then there's going to be a higher standard. We're going to want a higher standard from these financial advisors.
Mm-hmm. No, and you make a good point that there is a potential compliance reason for this. As I say,
right.
You know, if every advisor knew in 1999 what I knew and pulled my clients out of the market, the Dow would have dropped to 1,000. It would have been devastating, absolutely devastating. So there is a reason for the greater good to keep the blindfolds on people. I mean, you know, we may never find out back in, what was it, the 1970s, whether or not we really had UFOs land here in the United States. We may never find out. The government might be intentionally keeping the blindfolds on us for our own good. And I guess there's areas where that's okay, but my only concern is I personally believe that when it's people's life savings at stake, people really deserve to be armed with the truth about these cycles, and to make you know, really fully informed financial decisions.
I agree. All right, since you brought it up, I have to ask you the question. That is, what do you see happening? When do you suspect or think that the next correction is going to occur? I've heard people say that they expect it within the next 12 months. So we're looking 2017. I've had multiple people say that we should start expecting a correction. What is your thought?
Yeah, I fully expect that. Frankly, the market's overdue. The correction should have occurred. You know, when you get in one of these long-term secular bear markets, there's a couple of truths that hold. First of all, 2013, we broke over the market levels from 2000. So the secular bear market, you know, in theory, ended in the year 2013. Well, ironically, that would really make for the single shortest secular bear market on record here in the United States if we did make a permanent recovery in 2013. But I also know that every secular bear we've ever had has had three or more major drops within it, sometimes four, five, or six. And this time we only had two. So to me, the only reason this third drop didn't happen in 2013 is because the unprecedented levels of government stimulus influenced by central banks around the world. And now that it seems, especially after Draghi's comments or lack thereof last week, it's why this volatility is returning. You know, we've had corporate earnings for the last five, looking like going to be six quarters that are down. Real growth, that's 1% if we're lucky. You know, things are not terrible, but they're not great, certainly not to justify these high levels. So yeah, I think as soon as the drug of low interest rates and stimulus ends, I think we'll get back to some semblance of normalcy.
Yeah, and I'm really hoping, and I know this is going to sound very selfish of me, but I'm really hoping that the real estate market tanks a little bit more. You know, it's corrected, it's rebound. A lot of people says it's stable. I really need a a drop in the real estate market, because I need to buy some housing, and I can't afford it at the current market price. I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona, and everything is just overpriced, and I'm looking for that correction. And it's just me being selfish, but oh well. You know, the other thing that I want to talk about, David, because this doesn't make the headlines as much as that I think it should, and that is when you have a correction, people who have the liquidity, who have the mental, the inside game to use your phrase there, to invest in the market, really do well. I mean, Warren Buffett, I think, is the most famous investor we have, and he says, "I always buy when everybody's selling and sell when everybody's buying." And this guy is lost ever.
Well, he has lost, but he wins enough to make up for those losses and a lot more. But yes, you're absolutely correct. You know, we're taught as average investors to buy and hold. You know, brokers are taught day one in stockbroker school, you know, it's not about timing the market, it's about time in the market. But let's face it, the rich get richer for a reason. They have cash on the sideline to take advantage of real estate after a major downturn, take advantage of the stock market after a major downturn. And I'm always telling people that exact same thing. Why do we want to do what the average people do? If you want to become wealthier, why don't you do what the wealthy people do? But again, it's just another example where I think, you know, we're taught by Wall Street to stay fully invested. And if you think about why that is, you know, think about it. If people were to take huge amounts of money for long periods of time out and sit them in the sidelines on cash, Wall Street couldn't keep charging fees and commissions on that money. So it really is to their benefit to tell the average Joe America to stay invested in the buy and hold, when the reality of it is you hit the nail exactly on the head. So I know that you have at least one of the seven core values when it comes to being a good investor. You just proved that to me, because you have that good gut instinct. And I agree 100%.
All right. So let's talk about this. The book again is Return on Principal, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad. So let's run through the seven real quick.
Sure. The first one is financial overprotection. As even Warren Buffett has said, if you lose 50% on your money, you have to make 100% gain. And the reality is people today, you know, we talk about your previous guests talk about that, the hippopotamus portion of the brain. Well, I always talk about
the hippopotamus.
That's right. I always talk about, you know, normalcy bias, what psychologists talk about, that, you know, our earliest paradigms are what shape our experiences, what's happened to us in the past, what we expect to happen in the future. And that's a little bit what he was talking about. And the reality is that the same is true with money. And most people today who are preparing for retirement, who are on that final descent into retirement, started investing in the markets in the 80s and 90s, the best bull market in U.S. history. So their initial paradigm is, gee, I just put my money in stocks, and the more risk I take, the more return I get. That's right. And people lost sight of overprotection. They lost sight of, gee, saying, how do I can't just be an offensive coordinator. A good football team has a good offensive coordinator and a defensive coordinator. I need to be both. So for people who are members of the income generation, especially, financial overprotection is one huge value. If you know you're that guy who's willing to swing for the fences every time, or, you know, not lay up and try to hit that shot over the water onto the green, well, then that should be a bell that goes off in your mind, an alarm that says, well, maybe I'm not overprotective enough to manage my own money as I'm in that final descent into retirement. The next one is financial detail orientation. You know, if you're just going to look at a five-star rating on a mutual fund or some summary report on a particular stock and make a decision based upon that, well, that's not enough. You know, maybe when things were going well in the 80s and 90s, that could you can make a lot of money doing that. But right now, you need to be much, much more detail-oriented than that. If you're buying bonds, you know, we learned in 2008, you can't just follow the Moody's financial ratings. I mean, there were AAA bonds that were on the verge of bankruptcy within a few months. You have to look deeper than that and look at the financials of the company. Are you detail-oriented enough? Number three, diligence. Let's face it. Investing takes work. And, you know, Socrates said, know thyself. If you're the kind of person who, yes, I'm a sitter today and look at my accounts and see how things are doing, and even if I just take an hour a day, but then your friend calls you and says, hey, let's go play golf. If you know you're the kind of person who's going to say, no, I'm going to go play golf, well, then, you know, when we say diligence, it's not a bad thing if you don't have it. It means you just don't love investing enough to be diligent at investing your own money, and that's important. And that also reflects on financial advisors. One of the questions I always tell people to ask is, ask your advisor how they get their research, and that's telling. You know, if they're not doing a lot of their own research, if they're buying their research from independent from third party companies that aren't so independent that have an axe to grind, then that should be a warning sign. Principles 4 and 5, coachability and leadership, they kind of go hand in hand. You know, are you set in your ways or are you coachable enough? When presented with a preponderance of evidence that something you always held true to your heart in the financial world is now wrong, do you have the coachability to take that evidence, adopt it, and change your style? Okay? That's coachability. Or are you stubbornly set in your ways? And this goes, again, for advisors, too, because there are a lot of advisors that are set in their ways. You know, again, and that right. shouldn't surprise anybody because there are a few orthopedic surgeons that become chiropractors, a few chiropractors that ever become orthopedic surgeons, right? But not only that, but do you have the leadership ability? Are you willing to take the road less traveled? Are you the kind of person who, gosh, if the crowd isn't going down this road, I don't feel so comfortable? You know? That's how mutual funds became so popular. You know, the crowd's going down the mutual fund road, and people said, well, okay, yeah, I'm just going to follow that. And the last two are kind of overlapping. The principle 6 is financial honesty. Being brutally honest with yourself about the other 5 core values, and frankly, checking to see if your financial advisor is being brutally honest with him or herself with their strengths and limitations. You know, doctors refer you to specialists. Lawyers refer you to specialists. Financial advisors, they tend to say, oh, I can handle that. I can do that for you. You're aggressive. Well, I specialize in aggressive investors. You're conservative. I specialize in conservative. So you got to make sure you're working with somebody who's willing to be brutally honest also with his or her strengths and limitations. And last but not least, financial fearlessness. You know, if you jumped out of an airplane without a parachute, that wouldn't be fearlessness. That would just be plain old stupidity, right? but if you had a perfectly packed parachute, then, okay, maybe it is fearlessness. If you had a little training and, okay, I can get over my fear of heights, so let me go do it. And financial fearlessness, when people approach retirement especially, really comes from following the other 6 core values. You know, if you've been overprotective, and you've been detail-oriented, you've had the diligence to do your work, and the coachability and leadership to change when faced with a preponderance of evidence that a change is needed, and you've got all those characteristics and you're brutally honest with yourself, then at the end of the day, you can retire and be financially fearless. You know, what kills me is when I see people retiring and they just are doing enough to get by. I get somebody come in, oh, I make $100,000. Well, what do you need to retire on? Well, $30,000. And, you know, I know that unless that person's saving $70,000 a year today, they're quoting me their basic bills. And to me, it's not about just the basic needs. It's about the dream. It's about painting the dream as to what you want your life to look like. And that shouldn't end the day you retire. Frankly, in many ways, that should begin the day you retire. And that's absolutely what financial fearlessness is all about.
And I agree with you. You know, my wife and I, we have 2 kids left in the house.
and we're making plans to travel. And we're blessed. We have five kids, and my wife and I have explained to our five children that one of them must be ridiculously successful because they're part of our retirement plan, and that's part of our fearlessness. And it's
yes.
And it's also
yes.
part of our what do you call it of our financial protection is our kids. No, but I'm just kidding. But yeah, but you know, bottom line is we have a couple of kids left at home. We're looking forward to being empty nesters or and to start traveling. We want to spend a chunk of our quote retirement money on travel.
Right.
And be able to do some of those things that we have put off. And I like this idea, this, you know, the financial protection, being the financial details, financial diligence. Coachability. Yep. Leadership, being brutally honest. I think that one is the one that we all probably need to do a real gut check on.
True.
I think being brutally honest all the way through all of these seven steps, and then of course having that fearlessness. I think that back to what you're saying about living the dream. The dream is not to retire and have a lifestyle that is less than what you're accustomed to. You know, your dream should be big enough. And your financial planning should be big enough to say, okay, listen, I'm used to making $100,000 a year. How do I keep that lifestyle going? And there's nothing wrong with having some flexibility. Hey, I don't really need $100,000. Maybe I could get away with $80,000 because I no longer have a mortgage and stuff like that. But, you know, bottom line is I think that people need to be fearless and start planning to maintain their lifestyle and start thinking, okay, I'm going to need, you know, X amount of millions of dollars in various investments to keep my lifestyle going. And I think one of the biggest issues, David, that we, when I say we as a society, have is that we're not used to thinking in large numbers. You know, a lot of people have no idea that, hey, in order to make $100,000 a year off your investments, you're really going to have, you know, anywhere from a million, you know, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but you're going to have somewhere $1 million paying you 10% interest, you know, and a lot of people just can't wrap their mind around what it really takes to live the dream.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That happens because, you know, think about it. We're children. We all dream. Everybody wants to be a millionaire and everybody wants to be a fireman, you know. So in most cases, those two don't necessarily go together, but that's okay because as a child, you dream. But then as you go right. through life, if you don't get huge successes right away, then all of a sudden you start to think smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it becomes just about getting by. And that's unfortunate. I love to see people when they can build their retirement for whatever it means to them in a way that empowers them. And they can live the retirement, the lifestyle that they truly, truly want. And as your previous guest said, a lot of people, it's interesting because a lot of people retire and don't really fully retire. Maybe they're starting their own business. They're doing something that they want to do work-wise. It's part of the characteristics of all of us baby boomers. We're all wired the same in that way. So it's no big surprise. But there are some people today who really do want to be able to have a home here and a home there and be able to spend more time with the grandchildren because they live in a different area. They want to take a big trip every year and bring the children and all the grandchildren with them and pick up the tab because it's quality family time. There are people that want to do mission work when they retire, and that takes time and that takes money. But the first step is that people need to make that dream, and I believe that if people do that well before retirement, then they'll get their goals set up in such a way so that unconscious part of their brain called the reticular activating system is much more apt to help them accomplish the goal. That's the part of the brain that when you go out and buy a red Toyota Corolla, that same day you see 20 red Toyota Corollas on the road. It's that subconscious part of the brain that's programmed to recognize things when your brain focuses on it. And that's where creating these goals in advance of retirement and creating these goals in sensory-specific fashion, I mean, literally having people sit down and write out what their perfect day in retirement looks like and to write that dream, and not just to do it from a left-brain mathematical standpoint, but to do it using all your senses, you know, to be creative, to write about, gee, what does the retirement look like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? What does it feel like? You know, the more apt you can do that, the better you are to reach that goal. You know, for example, you know, you want to buy a retirement home on the beach. Well, it's important to be able to really visualize and live in advance the sensory-specific experience that you walk out in the morning with your cup of coffee in your hand and the sun is shining down on you and the coffee smells good and you can smell the salt air and you hear the waves crashing. That type of goal preparation is what gets the reticular activating system, that part of your unconscious brain, to move toward the goal. And if you can do that kind of work earlier on in your life, even if, heck, if it's only 10, 15 years before retirement, do it. It's never too late. That's going to help you focus on all the things that you need to do to get closer. It's amazing how powerful the unconscious part of the mind is. And that's what values really speaks to.
You know what, and I love that, and it's interesting that, you know, here you are, you're talking about the reticulating activating system, RAS, R-A-S, and then we had the other gentleman who talked about the hippocampus or the hippopotamus, as we both like to refer it to, and so it's been a very brainy, a very neural show today. But anyway, the book, again, Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad, David Scranton. Thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a blast. Looking forward to having you back again, David.
It's been a it's been my pleasure, Bert. Thank you so much.
You bet. Good stuff there from CEO and founder of Sound Income Strategies and David Scranton. And again, the book is called Return on Principle, Seven Core Values to Help You Protect Your Money in Good Times and Bad, because guess what? If it's good to, you know, if it's going to be good, it won't stay good forever. And if it's going to be bad, it won't stay bad forever. So you really need to have both strategies. My brother is a big fan of saying, and I totally agree with you, that it's never so good it can't get better, and it's never so bad it can't get worse. So in good times and bad, I think it's a great strategy. Remember, when it comes to you or your money, I think, just like David pointed out, you have to be fearless. What would you want? You have to write it out. You have to be fearless about that. I totally believe that we were put on this planet to be successful. You just have to define what success means to you. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.